Yes, on a dream. Make you be dancing in the street. And that big band keeps on playing. Oh, Joe Henry's retreat. Only dream. Only dream. Oh, only dream. But it's only a dream.
When we talk about being present, being in the now, the future is, as you say, the future is but a dream. But you're also someone who talks about taking the initiative to develop something. You know, if the future is just a dream, then you don't build a church to exist in that future.
As if there was a problem dreaming?
Ah, see, exactly. So I just want you to maybe speak to that idea of when I think a lot of people, people could take this as criticism if they want. I mean, I do see a lot of people who speak of the now and seem to stagnate, as if living in the now was an excuse to not have to do anything because you're already present. And yet I see it as you're always present, so if you're always present, you're always in development, you know, and that's a very, very fine line, because when you, it's, again, we get tripped up on the words, but when we say you're developing something, well, that's thinking towards the future. So maybe you have a better way of sort of wording that, but that's where I think a lot of people get tripped up very, very often.
Well, my now contains this dream. My now contains the sense of my destiny. Okay, and my now is a call to action. Okay, if you're just sitting back and saying, okay, I'm ever present in the now, somebody else roll another one and we'll smoke that too, then you're just lethargic. Your now is a catatonic state. And the formula is love under will. Will is a dynamic state. Will is a call to action. And if you can't clearly define the action that you're doing, you know, I heard some, 20-year-old AA student recently, and this guy's a dork, let me assure you, say, will is for me ever refining the nature of my star. What the hell does that mean? Ever refining the nature of your star? What, are you trying to make a fine wine out of your blood? Will is action. It's the dynamic of what I'm doing. It's where I'm going, because there is no such thing as standing still. The earth is moving at like 75,000 miles an hour through space. You couldn't stand still if I knocked you unconscious. So you have to be moving. You're constantly changing. What are you transforming into? The now is a moment of transformation. I am completely different now as we near the end of this podcast than I was when I began it.
Beautifully said. Kevin, what are your thoughts on, you know, sort of how the quote-unquote now gets used?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting subject. I would say that working with ayahuasca actually has given me pretty powerful kind of gnosis, personal gnosis about presence and that relationship to the future that is now, you know. I guess it was, yeah, there was one ceremony where I realized that, you know, the peace that I had achieved in that ceremony and the amount of letting go I had done with some of the things I had holding me back from the past, in that space where I let go of the past and accepted the now, I realized that at that exact moment, I had changed my future dramatically simply by having achieved that peace. So that's something I've continued to carry with me, and it's something that resonates with my work in the AA, where we say that, you know, stability is change and change is stability. And so the now is being present, and but it's also acknowledging that being present is constantly advancing, you know. And I guess ultimately, like, what I do resonate with is the idea that there really is only now, but now is like, I guess it's kind of a weird question, but like, we've inherited now, so what are we going to do with it, you know? And it's
sort of like that question of how am I not myself? It's like, how am I not present? You know, it's your present is an ever-changing moment in the stillness. It's a sort of Zen idea, right?
Right, yeah. I think that's really the key, is really that, you know, stillness is almost, can kind of get border on stagnation in a way, you know. So stillness maybe isn't exactly the best metaphor, but it relates to a certain proper quality, I guess. But like, yeah, but I think it's kind of weird, but I think it's got to do with, you know, being incarnated in a way, is that everything is always ongoing, you know. So to address that is more powerful than to really try to stand still and promote maybe that, you know, in a way. Like, it's more it's more suitable to shoot for constant growth than for stillness, you know. I don't know how to quite nail any more simply, but
that's a great way to say it, Kevin. That's really, yeah, a great way to say it, you know. Stillness is an illusion. You can't be still.
Mm-hmm.
It won't happen. Even if we could freeze the Earth spinning around the sun and stop its rotation on its own axis, you'd still have cells changing and growing and dying and everything else going on in your body. There is no such thing as stillness.
Right.
So why would anyone put the philosophy on that?
So you mentioned, Paul, you mentioned this idea of love under will.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, I think this is another concept that people get tripped up on very often. How would you explain to someone what the phrase love under will means?
Well, love is our contact, our connection with each other. It's the dynamic force that both attracts us to each other and repels us from each other. Okay, they're just two sides of the same coin. So we do nothing without love. All is love. Okay, then we can exercise our own individual effort built on that foundation. This is also a big problem in the Thelemic community, because everybody focuses on will while they trash each other to death, and they have no concept of the kind of love that they're practicing, which they're practicing in blind ignorance. Nothing wrong with hating another person. You can choose to hate somebody because you're repulsed by them. But that's a form of love. If you're not conscious and cognizant of it, you're practicing thelema 50% in the dark. And we need to understand that we manifest individually within the community, and you cannot. The individual is nothing without the community. The community is nothing without individuals. And there's your formula, love under will.
So when you said that people are doing only 50% of it, I would agree with that, because I see people who focus on love but not on the will, or vice versa.
Yeah, so you have the other side of it, the universal love and the unconditional love people, and they run around pretending, oh, I just love everybody and everything, say one thing they don't like, and they come on you with vitriol that'll scare an ant out of an anthill. And so they're living in their own delusionary world as well. The people that are focused on the will, oh, it's my will to fuck your daughter. No, it's not. this whole reinforcing ignorance, this blind cycle of thought, is nothing more than libidinal impulses that now have created a whole generation of people veiling their vices in virtuous words, because the orders themselves have not been founded by initiates nor adepts. They have failed to initiate, and they have misled a whole bunch of people into believing that they have been initiated, and they haven't.
And since I think this is such an important subject, Kevin, what are your thoughts on the web under Will?
Oops, sorry, Kevin, I just had to turn my mic on there. To me, love under Will is something really natural. I think Paul really, you know, nailed it before in saying that, you know, simply the nature of our existence in this kind of, subject, object, and then reality. But I don't know. I guess it's like it's the way to heal the illusion of subject and object at the same time, love, you know? So it's like, love is a very all-encompassing fundamental thing. So yeah, I ultimately, am attracted to this philosophy because it postulates, you know, love as the foundational nature of all things. It's how we're all brought into this reality, you know, and it's what gets us all to work every day and, you know, brings us home and inspires us to create beautiful things. And it just really, yeah, it just makes the world go around in beautiful ways. So I think learning the art of love is something really powerful for the future. Because I think the past is filled with, or the past was filled with, a lot of misunderstood love, a lot of, the patriarchal history that we're making our way out of is a lot of actual narcissistic self-love on the part of the male executors of that paradigm. And I think, you know, our whole world is going through a kind of transformation in how to love. So I find this philosophy really interesting and empowering, particularly because it, to me, it really just represents, you know, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will. To me, it really sums up this beautiful formula that to me, it's the closest map to the territory, you know. And I think it's the best thing I can offer other people is that art of love under will.
So
In seeking my will and also practicing love. Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were done there. If love is the thing that inspires us and will is then taking action on that inspiration, what would you guys like to see more people taking action on?
Education, real learning, because that's the key. Remember, know thyself. The first word there is know. To know, the four powers of the Sphinx, to know, to will, to dare, and to be silent. We have a lot of people doing no work at knowing and thinking they already know. They think they're sex magicians because they've learned how to either just have sex or to have some kinky form of sex. This is the biggest problem I see in Thelema today, because love under will, to many people now, means BDSM or some other perverted variety of sex or some way, some other dysfunctional behavior like, well, I can get married, but I can fuck three other women too. And they're veiling their vices in virtuous words, and they're not practicing love at all. So love has come to mean sex, and yet any healthy person knows there are forms of sex that have nothing to do with love. So to know, real knowledge, real education, this is gnosis. And real education doesn't come because you underwent an initiation ceremony. Real education doesn't come because somebody removed the mask and played with your pee-pee. Real education comes because you hit the books, because you sat down on the psychotherapist's couch, because you examined the interaction that you just had with your neighbor or with your wife or with your dog. You know, and you learned and studied your responses and your the emotional feelings that get aroused in the various situations of your life. You pushed your attention span and learned to study things that were at one point beyond you, that you've learned to create, went through the pain and agony of learning how to paint, play the piano, or just dance and move your body, or go to the gym and lose 25 pounds. You know, this is hard stuff. This is the reality of it. Just standing there and proclaiming, oh, I'm now a member of the Liberal Val Legis, and I am the Grand Poobah of King of Thelema for all the world because I can say the magic words and win $50. It's a joke. And this is what they're all doing today. You know, the few now have become the masses, supposedly. And when the masses all think that they're masters, there's no master. And when they're all thinking the same thing, nobody's thinking. And thinking is the key. This is all about the mind. And the body's got to be well for the mind to work. And if the body is either so lost off on dope that it doesn't know whether it's coming or going, or it's so lost in libidinal pleasure that it can't even control itself for a minute, and you're going to fuck like dogs in the middle of the mall, and you don't care who's watching, because all these people put naked pictures of themselves on the internet. You know, we're not being civilized anymore, and that the leaders of these occult lodges turn around and just say, oh, well, that's all fine with us. Hey, you know, it's we'll film the Gnostic Mass and let everyone see the girl's titties on the altar. You're desecrating stuff. These guys don't know what they're doing. And there's a whole mob following them now that thinks they're right.
I think that's a really interesting point because, you know, with... when we say everyone has their own genius and everyone has their own gnosis, and we want people to do what they will, I guess, you know, the sort of distinction here is, are you passing judgment on the actions of others, but at the same time, to not ever do that, are you, I don't know, enabling destructive behavior and not nurturing behavior.
Yeah, this whole injunction against judgment. Every moment of every day, you're making judgments all over the place. Is that girl pretty enough for me to ask out? Do I really like whole wheat bread? You're making judgments all day long. Okay, so continue to judge. Judge intelligently. Make real judgments. Okay, learn critical thought. Learn to challenge your own opinions. Am I really right? Is Obama really a good president? Is Obama really a terrible president? Whatever it is, can you really challenge yourself to get at a better opinion? Remember, Plato told us there is no fact. No such thing as facts. There's only correct opinion. Can you make your opinion that much more correct? Can you turn around today and say, that which I believed in for the last 25 years, I now suspect to be wrong. And I'm going to change my opinion. You know, this people can't do. And this is the very thing they need to do. Critical thought is such a key. It's something people don't have anymore. Look at Facebook. It's nothing but sound bites designed to produce knee-jerk impulses. And then everyone thinks it's right because it feels good. That's just the libido at work. That's not the intellect.
Yeah, if I could chime in on that. Also, I feel like, you know, like you said, what would we like to see from other people, I guess? I think there was that question before.
Yeah, if we want people to exercise their will, is there an ideal will to be exercised? Something like that, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, I think I was just inspired to say that I think ultimately, like, you know, I would hope everyone does whatever their unique, you know, will and trajectory is, you know. But I think the thing about offering, you know, spaces and communities and philosophies to other people in this way, I think is that that self-reliance and that critical thought that Paul is also talking about is really this idea that we can all be a lot happier if we criticize this now that we've inherited. You know, like we've been told, we're raised by other people, our whole world is full of you know, the educational institution and the government institutions and the cultural institutions and all these things that try to mold us into some particular, you know, or some relative coordinate. And so what I've found is that this stuff is, you know, the spiritual work and the you know, the work of love and the work of will, is that I can make myself, I can empower myself, I can be a happier person, I can challenge the maybe detrimental assumptions that I've inherited from, you know, my culture and stuff like that. And so I can then live a more healthy life for myself and then leave a more healthy, you know, trace on in history, I guess, you know. And that's a weird way to break it down. But I mean, I do feel like it's, I think maybe it's a yoga concept too, that, you know, when you improve yourself, you improve others in that way, that you lead by example or something, and not to have some kind of egoic, you know, drive behind that. But I do feel that, you know, if everyone gets better at love and will and life and stuff, and leads by example, then that nature can much more easily arise in everybody, and less people suffer, you know, from illusion and stuff. You know, the illusion of being disempowered, the illusion of being, you know, a sinner, and all these other kind of ideas that, you know, people inherit and stuff. So I guess that's the ultimate thing that, you know, I find great about the Gnostic current and the promotion of Gnosticism and things like Thelema, is that it says, you know, you know, you're not what's the word? It's not even like really in my vocabulary anymore, but what's the original sin or whatever, you know, like all these, there's all these like programs that, you know, kind of degrade our experience. So if we use critical thought and if we use, you know, our hearts and stuff like that, we can really come to a better reality tunnel, you know, and then help other people maybe, if that's,
yeah, if will. You use critical thought, you're not another member of the herd. You're not one of the sheep any longer. Okay, you're standing out. Okay, these herds that keep arising are really incredible. We're seeing them now in Thelema, which was once a philosophy that was said to be meant for the few, is now coming to be meant for the many, and it's getting popular. You know, I'm not going to say that it's getting popular to the point where, you know, there's a social movement going on, but we're seeing movie stars and rock stars getting into it. And for the most part, these movie stars and rock stars are pigs, right? They're, you know, young kids trying to shake off the kid mold, and they're acting like jerks. And they're doing really kinky things, and everyone's going, well, you know, Molly Cyrus does it, and she's a Thelemite. And this idea is horrible. It's destroying the philosophy. And yet we're seeing everybody turning around and saying, well, everyone else is doing it, so let me take a picture of my tits too.
I think, you know, for myself, I don't really see the idea of this being something that's popular or amongst the masses as really an issue? Because I think that would almost be an ideal, is that as many people as possible that could be turned on to true gnosis would be the ideal. I think this is why I keep coming back to the idea of love under will, because if we just have these two concepts, but we put them in the wrong order, if will is the one on the bottom, if will is the foundation, and then you put love on top of that, well, all you have is a love of power. But if you put love as the foundation and then put your will on top of that, well, then you're taking action from a place of love. And I wonder if it's not so much the issue being that it's becoming more popular or popularized, but that in its speed to be popularized, it's forgetting to fully expound that distinction.
Well, yes, and I would agree with you, and there is a technical explanation for some of this, or at least a scientifically measurable point. Remember, approximately 5% of our society has an IQ of 125 and over. So if you have a populist movement, you're dealing with average and not genius intelligence. Now, I'm not saying 125 is a genius, but it's certainly above average. And if you have a populist movement, the people between 90 and 110, where the overwhelming majority of people are, you're not doing anything intelligent. And when Thelema starts hitting this populist mold, well, then the formula of will as the foundation comes into play, because those few that can control Thelemic thought, the ones that can have own the trademarks and whatever else and copyrights of Thelema, well, now they've got power. And haven't we learned that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely? So now we have a dynamic where the book of the law tells us, thou shalt not change so much as the style of a letter inside that holy book. And Bill Breeze comes out and says, we're going to change the word from fill to kill. The very foundation of temporal power. I control something as long as I can destroy it. That's the nature of temporal power. This is what is emerging now.
But again, to make to clarify, because you had said earlier the idea that the old masters are dead and we have a new living knowledge, so we're allowed, you know, in your system, you're allowed to have new holy books. How do you measure that against the idea of not changing a single letter?
Let new gnosis come forward in its own new book. But if we start altering the old books, if we start losing the accurate sense of our history, truly from whence we came, and we start distorting, well, now it's getting Orwellian. That's newspeak.
Yeah, absolutely. You're just sort of getting to rewrite history over and over again, right?
Yeah. So, you know, what? Iwas really meant kill? He didn't mean fill? He's changing his mind. He made a mistake. What value is prior human intelligence then?
So there's, we were just speaking of this idea of you know, love and will, and I keep coming back in my mind to this. What was it, Jimi Hendrix, who said, you know, you need for the power of love to overcome the love of power. You know, and I feel like this is sort of where we're at. I think when we look at society, it is particularly Orwellian, it is authoritarian, and there's definitely a love of power that is getting forced or being, you know, glorified. And I think it's a really, really dangerous, I mean, incredibly, incredibly dangerous trend that we're seeing. And at the same time, there's a lot of people that I speak to who play with Gnostic ideas. I don't mean that in a trivializing way. I hope that doesn't sound wrong when I say play with these ideas, but to say, you know, there are a lot of different ways to intellectualize that concept or to classify that concept. So I just want to kind of be as broad as possible. When I speak to a lot of people who use these ideas, they talk about the idea of a very classic Gnostic concept being the world is a matrix, right? That this is created by a demiurge. We have a sort of impure, false, dangerous God who has made something that it's not a real or ideal space to be in, something to escape and sort of go to this true realm of gnosis. And this is something that gets, again, very, very much confused. And I hear people say, this world that we are in right now is a hell or is a matrix, and it's something to escape. And yet I hear other people talk this idea of, no, we live here, this is something which is in its own right something beautiful and magical, but yes, it is imperfect, and this is where the will comes in to make it a better place. I'm curious how you feel about those sort of opposing thoughts.
Well, let's put it this way. There is one Gnostic scripture that has the demiurge and the savior cooperating to create the world. So there is a mistake being made in that most people have chosen to represent the ancient Gnostic codices as speaking in a unified voice. They did not. The demiurge is not an evil force in all of the Gnostic codices, only in some of them. The demiurge is the creative force itself. In essence, in Thelema, we might call the demiurge Babylon. She is the goddess. She is the one that says, God, don't stay as not. Try to figure out who you are. Don't you want to know? She's Eve tempting Adam to the apple. Don't you want to know? And that's the foundation of all human science, all of human aspiration, the need to know. And that's created the greatest beauty in the world. That's created symphonies and medicines, surgeries and athletics to extraordinary feats, mountain climbers and astronauts. You know, it's all of human aspiration has come in that one sentence. Don't you want to know? Somebody asked, I forget who was asked, but it said, why would you climb Mount Everest? And the answer was, because it's there. And that's the reason to do something. The second book of Liber 65, one of the Thelemic holy books, the child asks the swan that just aimlessly is floating and flying and diving and soaring and going nowhere. And he says, why do you even bother? You're going nowhere. What's the matter? Why are you doing this? And he says, you know, it's just weariness for anybody that would attain to a goal. You know, it's, you know, the modus operandi of living is to live. Just do it for the sake of doing it. You know, so these Gnostic codices and this matrix idea, yes, there is an illusion out there. Okay, you can get sucked into that illusion, but you can also use the matrix as your own power supply if you want to, and you can be a genius. It just depends on how you want to relate to it. Do you want to carry the old paradigm that this world is evil? Then you're living in the spiritual age. The spiritual age postulates that the only thing good is above. If you want to live in the material age, then you say there's no above, there's only this world. But if you want to live in the integral age, then you postulate both worlds. Both being just as good, each being a holographic reflection of the other.
Kevin, I have the same question for you. I'm curious what your thoughts are on escaping the world, escaping the illusion, or becoming embodied within it.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I particularly find myself resonating with a kind of fundamental joy and wonder of existing, because in my lifetime I have found that you know, this experience is unprecedented to my present awareness, you know. So I find that with enough examination, there's really nothing to actually expect of the world. You know, the world is a miracle. It's a beautiful thing. And, so I don't resonate with these ideas that we're born into a prison or a matrix or a world of sin or, you know, any of these ideas, because, you know, from my experience, you know, without maps, without cultural indoctrination and all these other things, the world is just a wondrous place. It's just a total mystery. It's a beautiful thing. And so am I, and so is the future. So, I find it hard to resonate with these crazy ideas of, you know, going to hell or being sure of a particular heaven or living for anything other than this very moment. And if anything, I've been able to find all of these things, heaven, hell, you know, whatever, and the mundane or whatever you want to call it, they're all in this very moment. So, yeah, they're very much the same thing. And, you know, people, I think, hurt themselves in convincing themselves all kinds of stuff. But as far as I look at the world, yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's a beautiful, magical thing. And if we can get hip to it, we'll suffer less from the illusion that it's this, you know, total bummer or anything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, you know, there's certainly stuff to change. There's certainly things that we can embed in our lives and the lives of others. And like, there's great work to be done there for everybody. But as a fundamental thing, I think the world is a beautiful thing, you know? So sorry if that was long, but I guess I tend to have,
that was great.
Yeah.
I know we want to kind of wrap this up soon. I'm curious, Kevin, Paul is a teacher of yours. If there was a question you could ask him, what would that question be?
Usually it's got to do with, you know, how to attain the best results from astral entities or something like that. let's think.
That's an acceptable question.
but I just wanted to make a little joke there. But I do think maybe what I would like to ask is, you know, Paul, would you say that synchronicity is something that gives kind of credence to the occult ideas of a universal mind or, you know, the concept of a grand unified nature, you know, that comes from concepts such as Nuit or, you know, the macrocosm and stuff like that. Do you have thoughts of your own on synchronicity and how it relates to man's relationship to the macrocosm?
Well, I still, I guess, hold the Jungian definition of synchronicity. It's coincidence that has meaning. And then I remember that there is no such thing as coincidence. So therefore, everything has meaning. And synchronicity is the coincidence that we observe that produce meaning inside of us. So, for example, you do a lot with the number 42. 42 is one of the two numbers of the Shem HaMforesh. You find a lot of synchronicity to it, and you're really doing a Kabbalistic practice. You're finding aha moments because you're recognizing the number 42, and it's showing up in this film, on that picture of the football player, on you know, the that one page number 42 in the book is the page that got ripped out, et cetera, et cetera. And well, sometimes I look at that and say, well, yeah, because to me, I'm not finding the meaning per se, or I'm not floored by it. I'm not aha'd by it. But while it but I observed that it's producing that aha moment in you, and since you are the observer of that situation, that's enough for me. You know, that's enough to say, okay, there's something to this. And so I found my way into your synchro-mystical world through the 42 and the other coincidences that you kept finding, because they started working on you, and I saw that they were having an effect on you. And to me, that's an effective magic. It's opening you up to the fact that the universe itself is a pliable menstruum that you can alter to suit your own will, to your own nature. And you create your world and you create your life. And 42 has become the magical key by which you create your life. And that that itself is an important concept. The synchronicities that have happened in my life that have produced those same kinds of aha experiences. And I think of Liber Vox Viva Voce Vel Video, and the chance meetings that I had of two people that were certainly much more than chance meetings, because both of these people seemed to know something about me that they could not have known. And they came up to me and said I needed to know something, and they gave me the information that I needed to know. It came completely out of the blue, and to this day I am still astounded by it. So the power of synchronicity, awesome. There's the one word for it, awesome.
Now, Paul, since your students are able to give light to you as well, I'm curious if you have a question for Kevin.
Ah. And a question for Kevin. Geez, you got to give me a moment to think on that. Maybe I'll try to think out loud. You know, if I can, I'll think out loud. In my view of Kevin, and I'll be objective here for a moment, I see somebody who lived at a time when I was young. In my early and late teenage years, I lived at the end of the hippie era. And Kevin is somebody that has captured that personality. In a lot of ways, and even the music of him and his peers is very much like the music being created in that era. And I guess the one question I'd love to ask Kevin, then, Kevin, you know, what does hippie mean to you?
I guess what the hippie means to me was it appeared to me a generation of people who were lucky enough to get exposed to an influx of potential alternate reality tunnels than they had been exposed to. And they appeared to be a group of people who chased their hearts, passions, and, you know, for better and worse, as history revealed in certain ways, but I guess to me, it really represents this this true acknowledgement of that now that we were talking about, and that knowledge that, you know, stability is in change. So I will say there's different elements of the hippie movement that I don't resonate with, you know, maybe how, you know, it stagnated in certain ways. And, you know, I'm not someone with all the answers or anything like that either, but I will say that I think the thing that inspires me the most about that movement was that it was people who were really like almost aware of their time in history in a way, and they didn't fear the creation of their own culture in the face of the monoculture that they were embedded in. So I think there's something really powerful about that that archetype and that kind of spring of the soul, that movement, those kind of attitudes represented and stuff like that. And so I guess I find myself attracted to that that model and that place in history, but not all of it either. But yeah, I guess that sums it up for me, you know.
Cool. I really like that answer, actually. The people that were aware of their place in history and were not afraid to create their own culture and buck the model culture that was there for them. That's a great way to recharacterize what the hippie movement was in its own day, despite all their other flaws.
And I think it's a perfect segue back to the church, because what you're trying to do is something, in a way, is very similar, which is trying to build your own foundation, your own culture, in spite of the prevailing attitudes of the past, 100, 1,000, 2,000 years,
Well, indeed, I've come to notice one thing, and it's funny. I was at the dentist yesterday, and the woman that was cleaning my teeth, the second time I had the same conversation with her, so to speak, I said to her, "You're the person I'm looking for." And what I meant by that is this: I am convinced that there is that 25 to 45 year old person, family. It's mom and dad and the 2.3 kids. They're on the corporate ladder. They're working their way up into life. They've got their mortgage now, and they're two cars and their 1.2 car garage, and they want to give their kids a religious foundation. They want to go to church on Sunday, but they don't want to go to that Christian church anymore. They don't want to be told that they're a sinner. They don't want to see a scarecrow hanging on the wall. All these things bother them, and they don't know what to do, because they really do need that hour of spiritual contact on Sunday. It's going to charge their batteries for the week and help them to feel a little bit better about their lives. And this is what we want to be at the church. We want to be the place where they can go and have a real dynamic spiritual moment, so that that can be the peak in their week when they go through the rest of their humdrum existence of fighting that corporate ladder and getting the kids to soccer practice and reading their bedtime stories and making the car payment and mowing the lawn and doing the garden in the backyard. That 60 minutes in a day where that beautiful Sunday afternoon with a Eucharist and then a meal afterwards. And a place to bring their kids to meet other people that are there charging their batteries too, and to feel some community with them, and to know there is community around them and not just their neighbors whom they're trying to avoid.
So tell us how people can help get this church off the ground.
Be a part of it. Find a way to be a part of it. I don't care if, we're going to do a Sunday service with an internet broadcast. It's going to broadcast at noon Eastern time every Sunday. It's a Eucharistic service. Turn it on, flip over to our channel on the internet, If you can, make a small $5 donation and be a part of the Eucharistic ceremony. That'll keep our building alive. And be there every Sunday. Participate in the service. If you can, move into the area. Be a part of our proactive community here. Let other people know about us. Study mysticism and Gnosticism and become yourself. Because the more you become yourself, the more you'll appreciate what we're doing.
Is there a website for the church? You said people can flip on your Sunday service. Where would they do that?
Ah, ask Kevin.
Basically we're going to be launching a Ustream account in the next month. And that Ustream account will not only be broadcasting our grand opening gala, which is a music show, we're going to be having some psychedelic rock bands playing at the church on March 22nd. You can check us out on Facebook at the Gnostic Church of Light or the Gnostic Church of LVX. And yeah, so you can tune in to the grand opening. The next day we'll be consecrating the church on that same live Ustream channel. So I would say follow us on Facebook, and you know, in the coming weeks you'll see some announcements about how to participate virtually or just keep in touch with us in general.
Oh, I have one more question that reminds me. So you obviously you have the Gnostic Church of LVX, and in one way it's a play on Lux, right? White, L-U-X. But is there anything with the Roman numerals? Are you trying to, is there a specific number, or is it just, does it have another meaning to you?
Crowley writes an essay on Lux and LXV as 65. The value of the letters themselves, it when turned into their Hebrew, when turned into their Latin values, L is 50, X is 10, and V is 5. So 65 is the number of the Holy Guardian Angel. And the Holy Guardian Angel is Tifereth on the Tree of Life. So it's not that each letter has a particular value, has a particular meaning, but that each letter isolated becomes a number. And then we can add that up to 65. And yet at the same time, it means light. It's the Latin word for light. Remember, they didn't have a letter U in the Latin alphabet. Yeah, it was exactly. A U. You know, so the Gnostic Church of Light. And the light, that is the light of love, flows from your spiritual center, that holy guardian angel, Asar Un-Nefer.
Wonderful. Is there anything you guys would like to add here at the end? Or?
Jeez, I said enough.
Any parting thought, Kevin?
I can't really think of anything, you know, other than, you know, if people are interested in Gnosis and Thelema and magic and mysticism, you know, follow our Facebook page. Keep an eye out for the kind of events we'll be hosting in the coming year and the internet stuff we'll be doing. And also just want to say thanks to you, Alan, and the Always Record community for, you know, hosting us and having us on and promoting the church. We definitely really appreciate it. And yeah, it's been a really good conversation. I've enjoyed it and definitely appreciate your time.
Same here, man. It was an absolute pleasure. I'm happy to speak to you anytime. And Paul, it was really nice to get to speak to you and meet you today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really enjoyed your questions. They were very well put, and you got a lot out of us.
Yeah, I think the listeners will get a lot out of it, too.
Look forward to it, Alan, Kevin, 93. Have a great day.
All right, see ya. Have a good one, Alan, 93, Paul.
Bye, guys. Be well.
Catch you later, brother. Peace.